Hello, curiosity seekers. Welcome to Dissecting Medical History. I'm Ange. I'm a travel nurse, medical history enthusiast, and your host. If you're looking for a storytelling formatted podcast with fun and fascinating topics on history and bios, then you are in the right spot. Please note this is not in any way medical advice. If you have anything that's ever discussed in any of the podcast episodes, please seek medical attention. Now, let's get this story started. Today, I'm back with my friend Kev to discuss the Philly Plague of 1793. Thanks for coming back, Kev.
Hi.
I wanted to talk about the yellow fever. It's a fever that's still active today, but this yellow fever epidemic happened in 1793 and pretty much crippled the city of Philadelphia. And I thought it was an interesting story, and I wanted to tell you about it. Had you heard about it before?
I've not heard about the Philadelphia pandemic specifically, no.
There was others in different times. This one particularly was crippling to the city. It was a brand new America. We had won our independence 10 years before this, and the federal government had set up their capital, so to speak, in Philadelphia. They hadn't gotten to Washington, D.C. quite yet. The capital of Pennsylvania wasn't established yet either. So the state Senate was also holding shop in Philadelphia. The capital of Pennsylvania is Harrisburg, but it just became a town in 1791. This epidemic happened in 1793. The state capital actually wasn't established until 1812. So let me set the scene for the summer of 1793, Philadelphia. That year, they had a pretty bad year for maladies. They had an outbreak of the mumps, scarlet fever, and the flu pretty badly in the beginning of that year. The city of Philadelphia has a population of about, back then, 51,000 people, which doesn't seem like a lot today, 51,000, but it was the largest city in America at the time. It's set between two rivers, the Delaware River and the Schuylkill River. I'm not sure how to say that, but it's in between these two rivers, and there are ships that come in to the wharfs from other cities like Boston. The ships that would come in and dock there, they would a lot of times just dump crap overboard if things were rotten. And in this summer, they had a really bad load of coffee, and they dumped it right out onto the river, onto the shore. And apparently the smell was so bad, especially in the summer heat, that it just smelled like it was rotten coffee. It just was like really wafting into the city. And people would throw out in their own property garbage. There was, I guess, on the shores, dead animals, rotten food. There was sewer runoff. The sewer would get clogged and just spill over. So the streets and the wharfs were pretty foul-smelling and disgusting, especially with homes in the streets and the alleys as well. So the summer of 1793, it was a pretty stinky year, like literally stinky. Like I said, there was no sewer system, so it would just kind of clog and run off. People were having to get their water from the wells at that time, and they said that the wells stunk pretty bad, that the water was pretty disgusting, and that's kind of what the city looked like at that time.
Well, that's a lot of foreshadowing for sickness.
Yeah, right? It's ominous. In the books that I read, they, you know, hindsight is 20/20, right? But one of the reverends was saying that he knew something was coming. And I feel like it's a Phil Collins song. You could feel it something in the air tonight. Right. But anyway, him and then this doctor that is pretty prominent in the town of Philadelphia, his name's Benjamin Rush. He also was like, something's coming, because of all of these other things that had happened in the beginning of the year, like the mumps and scarlet fever and stuff. But again, that's like hindsight. So I don't know if they really knew it or whatnot. It's thought that an unknown named French sailor was the first one to fall ill with the yellow fever on August 3rd of 1793. He was staying in a boarding house down by the water. Within the first week, 8 more people died on that same street of that boarding house. But okay, nothing to panic about yet.
Wait, 8 people died and that's not a reason to panic?
Yeah, because other things have happened before. They've had yellow fever before. They've had scarlet fever. There's several different types of fevers that are known. None of them I've heard of before. One of them was called jail fever, and there are some others that are, they're just summer fevers, they call them, like a cold. I think that's pretty much what they mean, is like they're cold, summer colds. But anyway, 8 people died on the same street within the week. But then 10 days later, around between August 19th and the 21st of August, the dead bodies were starting to be noticed. There was more patients.
That's an understatement.
There was more patients complaining of severe abdominal pain and a foul black bile that they were vomiting up. One of the doctors that was treating the patients, Dr. Benjamin Rush, that I just mentioned, noticed red spots on the skin called petechiae that he had noticed before. He was part of the 1762 yellow fever outbreak and felt like maybe it was the same thing. Yellow fever is hard to diagnose because it is similar to a lot of other viruses, so it wasn't for sure. But they would start feeling the chills first and then the fever. Then there was headache and backache. And then, of course, it got its name because people's eyes would turn yellow and skin, which is called jaundice. And that's when the liver starts to break down. And that's part of this virus, is the organs start to shut down, like the kidneys and the liver. So Dr. Rush was starting to tell those people close to him that they need to leave the city, that they, to protect themselves, they should probably, you know, go to their summer homes. And he warned.
This was a private message to him and his close friends.
Yes.
Sounds like insider trading.
Exactly. I don't think it's very fair. However, he wasn't for sure, but he did tell the mayor and the governor, both, like I said, were staying in the town of Philadelphia because that's where they were holding up shop. The mayor, Matthew Clarkson, decided other people should know. So he put an ad in the newspaper saying there was a dangerous infection going around. And he also put in the paper for the scavengers to clean the streets, to pick up the dead animals and the garbage, because a lot of them felt that the yellow fever was caused because of the foul air. They really believed that. So if he was trying to keep the people calm, it didn't work. Because then other people were starting to go, oh, then we need to leave too. So people were starting to leave the city. And they, if they could, I mean, obviously not everybody had a summer home or knew people with summer homes or knew people in other places that they could just pack up and go visit for a while. But those who could did. And they sometimes even left their servants behind to guard their houses from looters, but they, and some of them took their servants, but they were leaving. And it was estimated that 20,000 people left. 20,000. Now,
out of a city of 50,000?
Yes. So a little less than half of the people left the city. So you can imagine a lot of those people that left were the ones that had money. So if they're leaving and they have the money, those are probably the people that have the businesses and the shops. So they're leaving people behind that need those jobs to keep alive, to have some income. But the poor did have to stay, and some of the people that were well-to-do did stay out of a sense of duty. Even some of the physicians left. In the beginning of September, George Washington and many of the members of Congress and the cabinet even left. He left kind of quickly, and the aides didn't even take his important papers with him. So on a side note, at that time, there was no legal course for Washington, George Washington, to convene Congress outside of Philadelphia city limits. So they left Philadelphia, but he wasn't able to get any work done or a lot of work done because he wasn't able to get Congress back together. Apparently that wasn't a power he had at that time. So a lot of his hands were tied. Not a lot of his hands. His hands were tied.
Both hands.
His hands were tied when he was trying to get some stuff done. So still in September, whole families were being wiped out. Alexander Hamilton and his wife left the city after getting ill. Many of the federal government contracted it. And the governor of Pennsylvania was Thomas Milfin. And he also left the city, but before he left, he kind of gave the mayor this power that wasn't really a true power. He just kind of left him and said, I'm not feeling well, I'm going to my summer home. And he left him in charge, but he didn't have any power to do anything. The mayor is pretty much just an honorary title. But he stayed because of a sense of duty. His wife and son were already killed by the yellow fever. And so he just stayed, but like I said, no power at all to do anything. But he did try. He asked the College of Physicians to meet to figure this out, find out what was going on with the yellow fever, if there was something they could do. Because most of the deaths were near the water where the rotting coffee was, keeping the air pretty foul. They thought that was the root of the illness, and the doctors could not agree on the cause nor the cure. Or that even that it was yellow fever. Some of them didn't think it was the yellow fever at all. The doctors knew that it was killing about 50% of those that were contracting it. And at the time, there was about 80 doctors. But a lot of the doctors did die over this summer. And like I said, some of them fled. And a lot of them were working as hard as they could. They recommended cleaning the streets and setting up a hospital, avoiding fatigue, limiting alcohol intake, having airy rooms for the patients, keep linen clean, use vinegar or camphor on everything to ward off fever, to burn gunpowder to purify the air. And one of the things that they had suggested was to stay away from other people with a fever. Now, that seems obvious to stay away from someone with a fever because we know that that's the contagious phase, right? But that was something a little more radical at the time. And all of these suggestions were put in the newspaper to the citizens as what to do. So the fact that they told them to stay away from each other or to stay away from those who had a fever kind of started a little bit of a panic. And people would stay away from each other, but it became extreme. Like they were shunning the people that were trying to help them, like the doctors and even the ministers. They were starting to avoid each other on the streets. They would walk in the middle of the streets just to get away from each other. Then what shops were still open, they were closing those. They were staying away from funerals. Schools were being closed. People were staying home and cleaning their homes and burning logs in the fireplace in summer. Another doctor wrote in the newspaper to have a couple inches of dirt in every room of the house on the floor. Like they'd put couple inches of dirt on the floor, and then to change that dirt every day. Wow. I know. I couldn't figure that one out, but that's what they said. And then to inhale pepper and to take a lot of baths. Another doctor had a concoction that took 8 days to make that would ward off fever. So if you survived not getting yellow fever for 8 days, then this concoction would help you prevent getting it. There was also all kinds of elixirs and cures that were advertised in the paper or that were being sold in front of City Hall. So, like I said before, the newspaper was kind of like the Twitter of the old days. Each doctor was fighting each other because they couldn't agree, and they would fight in public in the newspaper ads. They would write not only their suggestions to the citizens about how to ward off or treat yellow fever, they would undermine and talk bad to these other doctors, like directly.
That reminds me of the other podcast about hand washing.
Oh, yeah.
Like one doctor saying, wash your hands. And other doctors saying, hogwash. Washing your hands doesn't do anything.
Right. But
he's loony.
In this regard, it's all public. They're like,
I know. It's funny to think about.
So there was a lot of reputations on the line. And that Dr. Benjamin Rush, he would take things very personal. And he did not like being told that he was wrong. And he was very wrong in this case. He was supposed to be a very, very good doctor. But in this epidemic, he proved to be not the greatest. And I'll talk about that a little bit. But anyway, so people were still dying, even with all these suggestions. And because the church would toll their bells for every death, the bells were going off quite a bit. I wouldn't say there was hundreds of people dying a day. Maybe 100 people would be dying a day. But that was still a lot for this amount of people that contracted. I mean, the population wasn't that huge. But if you compare it to the percentages to like the COVID today, it's a lot. So the church bells were ringing a lot. And so the mayor had them stop ringing because he felt like it was unnerving the people to hear those bells all day. But it kind of made it worse because once they stopped ringing, then you notice that the city was extremely quiet because nobody was there anymore. The streets were so quiet, except that he did order, I think it was the military to come in, and they were shooting cannons off because they wanted the gunpowder in the air because they thought the gunpowder helped purify the air. So no tolls of the bells. But then there was these loud cannons going off. I think that would be more, right. It'd be more unnerving.
I can kind of see the idea that that might, you know, the smell of gunpowder maybe would help some things. I mean, people light a match in a bathroom if it smells bad. So
yeah,
same smell of sulfur.
In the hospital, one of the worst smells, and I have a really sensitive nose. So for me, everything is extremely stinky, but there is a distinct smell for a GI bleed, a gastrointestinal bleed. It's a disgusting smell, very distinct. And the worse it is, the more it smells. So one of the things that we do in the hospital is we put cups of coffee grounds around in the person's room to help absorb the smells of that GI bleed. And it does help. I mean, people, of course, would rather smell coffee. It's supposed to absorb, but it also smells better. But it's funny that in Philadelphia, their main smell that was so bad was coffee. Like, I don't know what rotten coffee smells like, but you put that on top of gunpowder, that doesn't seem like it would be. Like, you're just taking one smell to replace another instead of using it to absorb a smell. You know what I mean? So I'm not sure if gunpowder was very effective.
Well, I'm guessing the the rotten coffee, that's, I mean, it was probably the raw beans rotting, or was it actual roasted ground coffee? Well, they probably didn't pre-grind like we often see today in stores and supplies.
I guess. It was probably beans. Yeah, it probably was beans.
Yeah, but was it roasted already, which you don't think of as being...
That's true. It probably wasn't. It was probably... dry.
But I suppose if it got wet in large volumes, that could still rot.
Okay, so the state legislator was trying to meet. And one of the people in that group, a doorman, had died. And it pretty much freaked out the rest of the Senate, and they fled. They were like, this guy, we're breathing the same air that this doorman breathed. And they pretty much left. And like I said before, the mayor kind of, not the mayor, the governor decided to, oh, I'm sick, I'm leaving. So the mayor kind of was there on his own, but the city officials, they were no longer there. They stopped showing up to work, including the night policemen, judges, clerks, secretaries, etc. They kind of just stopped showing up to work. The night policemen, there was only a handful left. There's supposed to be like 20 something people that would show up at night to patrol, and they just didn't. The street lights were not being lit anymore, so the streets were left dark. So crime did go up. People were looting, people were breaking into apothecaries and stealing medicines and things like that. They kept that out of the newspaper, but it was something that was going on. Then the bodies of those that were dying, they would be picked up. There was carts that you've heard. Have you ever heard the
Bring out your dead. Yeah.
Well, that's what they were doing. They were rolling their carts and saying, bring out your dead. And they would take the dead to Potter's Field and dump them. But because the grave diggers weren't showing up to work, they were just piling up. The boats were coming to the dock, but there was no one there to accept them. Especially if there was like passengers, there was nobody there to get them. The farmers outside the city didn't want to come in anymore. When they did bring their produce, they would jack up the prices extremely high. The poor started wandering the streets or being stuck at home without assistance. The people were having a hard time paying their rent, and so they were being kicked out of their homes. There was a group called the Guardians of the Poor, and they were asked to help. And at first they did. They took over places to help bring the sick. The first one was a circus, and they would bring the sick there, but the people around the circus area did not like that. And so they ended up having to move, and they took over a mansion called Bush Hill. Now, they just took over the mansion, but the owner was in England. So they kind of just confiscated this guy's house, this mansion. At first, they had four doctors that they volunteered to come and help look in on the patients. But they didn't have a regular schedule. And so they kind of were never there. They just didn't show up very often. Volunteers are really hard to find. And then the guardians kind of just faded out of their duties. They were doing well at first. And like I said, they set up this hospital at the Bush Hill, and they were trying to help the poor get into shelters and almshouses, but either they just were getting more scared, or they lost interest, or they ran out of money, or whatever the case may be, they kind of just faded out of their services. But the Free African Society came to the rescue. The Free African Society was founded in 1787, and they were the very first organization in America that was organized by Blacks for Blacks. They came together to help other Blacks who were destitute, orphaned, or widowed. There were about 3,000 free Blacks in Philadelphia at the time, and about 200 that were still in slavery in the city. But of course, there was still a lot of racism. And even though their white neighbors were not historically very nice to them at all, they did not hesitate to help. Dr. Rush, he had this misconception that Blacks were resistant to the yellow fever. So he thought that this was a great idea because they can come in and help and not get the fever. And of course, that was not true. Hmm. So some of the members of this group had yellow fever before in their home countries in Africa, but that didn't mean that they couldn't get yellow fever again as well. They first started to assess the situation. They would go in on the streets to find out what was needed, how many were sick, how many were dead. Like, they just wanted to figure out what was needed. And they found out there was a lot of need. They would nurse people. They would help clean. They would help people do laundry. They were getting food and medicine and helping with family members that had sick. They did not ask for money, but they did take donations. And then they had their own group of Black nurses. And they became a source of controversy, which is extremely sad because the nurses were going in to help. However, a lot of them were doing like private nursing. Like, they would go into where a family was in real need. But because there was such a need, these white people started bidding for these nurses, which made the price for them go way up. Nobody complained about the produce being high or all of these other materials that were needed being jacked up, but people were complaining because the nurses were making too much money. But the nurses are putting their lives on the line, but again, they think the nurses are free from being exposed to yellow fever. There was a book that came out after the epidemic was kind of over, and the author of the book, he was a journalist, but he was observing this whole thing from beginning to end. And he gave praise to the people that had volunteered, to the Free African Society, except that he slammed the Black nurses because of this whole controversy with the money. And he falsely accused them of stealing, when in fact it was some white nurses that were caught stealing from patients and that were charging an exorbitant amount of money for their services. They were the ones that were actually asking for the money and getting caught stealing. I'll talk about the book later, but that was another point of contention. The landlords were raising the rents as well. There was one landlord who had gotten money for their tenants. They said that the tenants needed to pay the back rent or whatever it was. And the city had given them money, and someone gave them money, and then they turned around and kicked the tenants out anyway, threw out all their stuff. Some of the landlords, even Dr. Benjamin's landlord, came to him and asked for 3 months in advance rent. So they were all, everybody was hurting and everybody was trying to make up for it in some way. But of course, you know, landlords, that's another thing. Like, that's kind of one of the things that's going on today, is people are being kicked out of their homes because they can't pay rent because they don't have a job. It's like this downward spiral, right? And what do you do? The Free African Society would patrol the city, and they would take the ill to Bush Hill if they were very ill. They also helped find shelter for some of the homeless children, and they helped buy materials to build coffins. So from their assessment, they started to really take control of some of the things that were needed.
That was the Guardians of the Poor, or that was the Black organization?
That was the African Free Society. Okay. The Guardians pretty much are out of the picture at this point. They're not doing very much anymore.
Okay.
So the Free African Society was kind of the main volunteers at this point. But not surprising, the society also took a hit with the fever, and they were starting to die at the same rate as the whites. The mayor had expressed gratitude for their work, even when the black nurses' reputations were being smeared from that book that had came out. The society actually wrote a book in response to that other book by highlighting what they had done during this time. And that was endorsed by the mayor. So the mayor was very helpful in keeping the reputation of the Free African Society. So the mayor, Clarkson, he stepped in to help the city a little bit further. Because like I said, he had no authority. So he took a huge risk by putting together a committee. And like I said, he was having the streets cleaned. He did have that authority. He did ask the physicians to meet. He was halting ships that were coming from the West Indies. He was overseeing the volunteers, the Guardians, and the Free African Society. But he put together a special committee, which was illegal. But like I said, he took a big risk. He had a sense of duty. He felt like somebody had to take control. And they put together a committee of about 26 members. They all felt like there was a strong sense of civic duty for their city. And in that course of them volunteering, the 26 ended up being 12 because of illness and death. Wow. They ended up borrowing some money for medicine, coffins, and other necessities. Some of the money went towards and hiring grave diggers, nurses, and doctors. In the end, they spent $37,647.19. All of which,
fortune, then.
Yeah, that's a lot of money now. I think, I don't know what the equivalent is, but that would be what, millions or million?
I don't know. It'd be interesting to look that up in adjusted dollars.
The committee members were expected to pay that back out of their own pocket because they had no authority to be borrowing that money. So they had to borrow it out of their own pocket, like out of their own. And a lot of these members of the committee are just regular people. There was a mechanic, a teacher, a coach builder, an umbrella maker, cabinet maker, a tavern keeper, a merchant, and even a playing card maker. The tasks were divided, and they were able to help provide food, firewood, clothing to those that need it. They would even give money to some of those that needed it. They removed the dead from the homes, and they started burying the piles of bodies that were in the potter's field. They helped find shelter for the orphans. There was about 192 children that they had found, a lot of them just huddled in the streets that were homeless. And one of the committee members, his name was Israel Israel. He was very good at negotiations, and he was able to get a place for people to stay. And he was able to make out a deal with the owner of Bush Hill, who came back from England and found that his house was taken over by these people that were housing the ill and dying in his house.
Wow, that would be a surprise.
Yeah. Now, I'm sure somebody had written to him at some point and said, we're taking over your house. I don't know. But they did. When he came back, Israel had helped to negotiate. At Bush Hill, two volunteers came to help manage. One, the inside of the house, and one, the outside. And took over what the Guardians had started. The mansion was holding about 140 patients, and they could be housed anywhere from the house to the barn. And they built a structure that was about 60 feet by 18 feet, where they could also house some of the patients. They created a horse and cart type ambulance that were bringing the sick, the very sick, to Bush Hill. and then they would take the dying out in the same cart. They made beds, and they also repaired a water pump to help get fresh water to the patients.
Do you think they disinfected the cart between hauling dead bodies out and bringing sick people back in?
I do not think they did, because I don't think they felt... No, I don't think they did. Because they weren't thinking, like, that's a source of infection, because right. they still think it's in the air. But I did think about that, and I didn't see anywhere where they said they did, but I don't think they did. They probably did not. Inside the mansion, they cleaned and cleaned and cleaned. Patients were grouped together, so by the sickest would be together, the less sick would be together. They tried to keep them around the same equivalent. Each hallway had a volunteer Free Society nurse that would look after them. There was a full-time doctor that was volunteering. His name was Jean DeVries. He was French. And the other doctors did not like the fact that he was there because he was French. And the doctors were overruled because the doctors never showed up. They, like I said before, they didn't have a regular schedule. They weren't taking this seriously. I'm sure they're taking it seriously. They just weren't doing a very good job. And so here was a doctor that was there full time, and he was taking it seriously, and he had some pretty good advice. But the other doctors are like, oh, we'll start showing up. But they're like, no, it's too late. So he had some advice. I mean, not all of it was great advice, but he was on the right track. For instance, he would give sweetened wine to stimulate the blood. That probably is not the best cure or the best advice, but he was making sure that they were well fed. He would give them broths and creamed rice and fluids. That was important. He would make sure that the patients and their environment were clean. And he did very little bloodletting, whereas Dr. Rush did a lot of bloodletting. So he felt like that wasn't something that was going to work in this instance. He felt that the body should try to heal itself, which in a virus, there is no cure for yellow fever. And the best you could do is help the body in fighting it off itself. So it was pretty, he was close.
What was the rate of survival of the infected?
Well, okay, so they said once, at first it seemed like about 50%, but once they can get them to a point, like in this instance where they're giving them the best chance, if they got to the part of the infection where their organs started to fail, it was 50-50. So if they could get, so I would say maybe a 75% survival, perhaps at this point, if they could get them in a healthy state or in a healthier state. I think also the Bush Hill thing, because they were bringing them specifically to Bush Hill, they were, as soon as people were getting ill or fevers, they were taking them to Bush Hill. At first, nobody wanted to because the death rate was pretty high. But like I said, because he was starting to keep things clean and he was starting to give them fresh water, clean water, and food and stuff, I think they had a better fighting chance. Also, it was almost like quarantining them from the city. So in this regard, it was helping to lower the numbers of those getting infected in the city. So that was also helping. Now, in the other towns, they were starting to shut off people from getting in. So like New Jersey and surrounding towns in Pennsylvania, they weren't allowing people to stop. So if somebody was coming through, they had guards at these cities to make sure they didn't stop, that they're going to have to keep going because they didn't want. Yes, a travel ban. Exactly. They had a report of one lady in Delaware who was stopped They took her out of her wagon, stripped her, tarred her, feathered her, and ran her and her servant off.
Wow. Yeah.
Very extreme. But
just because she decided to stop in that town when she was not really allowed to?
Yeah, when she was fleeing from Philadelphia. Now, I don't know if she had had a fever at that point and was sick and they were trying to, you know, prevent her from spreading it, or if they were just upset because she was trying to stop and she, you know, whatnot, but that seemed a little extreme. The towns did give some money and food and clothing and livestock. And the nice thing about that was they could take that money and subtract it from the money that the committee had borrowed. So that was helpful. I think it was about $5,000 that they ended up collecting from other towns for help. The other thing was the mail was being delayed because the postmasters were starting to dip mail that was coming from Philadelphia into vinegar. And then, of course, they had to let it dry because they felt vinegar was like the to kill it. And George Washington was really upset about this because he was trying to get information about how things were going. And he couldn't get any information because he had to wait for the mail to dry.
Well, it just seems like, wouldn't the vinegar make the ink just run all over the place anyway? Or
did I guess not. I guess not, because that's what they did. And then they would stamp it after that this had been
certified treated mail.
Yes. So also the Reverend Helmuth, he himself was thinking that the people brought this plague on himself, on themselves, because of their sinning ways prior to this outbreak. He felt it was their fault. And even after the outbreak was wind down and people were going back to their normal lives, he felt like they didn't learn anything and they're just going to put themselves to hell because of their naughty ways. But he was very vocal about that. The epidemic did start winding down by the end of October. The deaths were starting to be about less than 20 a day. October 31st, Bush Hill had no more sick people and they waved a white flag, but that didn't last very long. They ended up back in operation early December, but it was a lot less and people were not afraid to go there anymore when they were getting sick. So they were able to function as a pretty good little hospital. The president, George Washington, on November 10th, rode into town all by himself on a horse to see that it actually wasn't so bad. The streets were clean and things were quiet. And
except for the cannons.
The cannons by then were probably long gone. But the president declared that it was safe to come back, kind of a thing. And so people did start coming back. And then by January, the worst was behind them. When people started coming back, they felt a little embarrassed for having left their fellow citizens. And some actually believed that it wasn't real. There wasn't very many of them. Like today, it seems like there's tons of people that are just still in that COVID isn't real thing, you know, and it wasn't quite that many people. It was just a few that were thinking this was all maybe not a hoax, but wasn't really real. The people that had died were died of something else, or they were foreign, or they had some excuses or whatnot, which they're denial. But I think it was probably denial because they maybe feel guilty for having left. I don't know. Yellow fever did return in the 1790s. But not to the same extent as it was at this point. It was estimated that about 5,000 people had died from this yellow fever epidemic at this time. Because of this epidemic, there were some changes that were made. The state government made changes in how they dealt with authority for making laws and managing money during a crisis so that they actually could do something during a crisis. And the federal government made some similar changes where they could call Congress in the event of a crisis if they had to in a different city. For some reason, they could only do it in Philadelphia, but now they could make, they had the authority to do stuff when there was a crisis. And then the city had made changes. They made a stronger effort to keep the streets clean and they're fresh. Homeowners were held accountable for their own property. And then there were stronger health codes that were put in place. And while there was no plans to fix the sewer system or even put in a sewer system, they did make some major improvements to the water system. So in 1799, the city put in a steam engine pump that took water from that Schuylkill River. I don't know how to say that river. That the water system would pump water by gravity into homes and businesses. And there was even enough water pressure that they could use it to like power wash the streets and to help the sewer, the sewage unclogged. And the people said it tasted and smelled good. Also, the doctors were still telling citizens that yellow fever had nothing to do with the water, but the citizens still felt like it did. And they still at this time did not realize that yellow fever was spread by mosquitoes and that mosquitoes like the water. So they would live in the water of the old wells and some of the swampy areas. Those two rivers, like I said, that surround Philadelphia were pretty swampy that summer. And that's where a lot of the mosquitoes were going to laying their eggs.
Right.
Yellow fever, which I hadn't really talked about before, is a viral infection that's spread by a specific mosquito that is from tropical areas such as Africa and Central and Southern America. It's also called yellow fever because of the yellowing of the eyes and skin known as jaundice. The symptoms include the fever, chills, headache, jaundice, muscle aches in the arms, legs, and back, nausea, and vomiting and fatigue. Now, the black vial is from the red blood cells that were destroyed. The dark is old blood, so it looks like black vial, but it's really just old blood. There's no antiviral medication for it. There is a vaccine, but I don't think at this time it's made in the U.S., but I think that it is in certain countries that have yellow fever outbreaks still. And it's spread through a mosquito, but it's actually a monkey that's the carrier. So it's usually in areas where there's monkeys. In 1880, Dr. Finley from Cuba did experiments with mosquitoes where he would take mosquitoes that had it and put it on people, give it to people, or have people that were healthy get bit by them. And he found that correlation. However, other doctors, of course, did not support his experimentations and said that it wasn't enough to support it. So it took another 20 years before someone took up his work. In the case of the Philly outbreak, it's thought that the eggs from these special mosquitoes were on the ships in the water barrels that they needed, but they needed a person to bite that had yellow fever. And so it takes about 12 days for the virus to make its way inside of the mosquito to the salivary glands. And then once that mosquito, and it was a female mosquito, the males didn't bite. The males didn't bite humans. They were more plant-based type. They're vegetarians, I guess. The mosquito would find a host, and then that's how it would spread. So it's thought that maybe those spots that Dr. Rush was talking about were not petechiae, but perhaps mosquito bites.
Interesting.
Because like I said, there was so much swampiness and bad water. There was probably a lot of mosquitoes that were roaming around, and maybe they were just really biting that summer, and that's why there were so many. Like I said, there is no cures, but some of the cures that these doctors had done were barley water, apple water, herbal teas, sweetened wine to reduce fever. they would put laudanum in red wine or brandy for rest. Then Dr. Rush did massive bloodletting. He also did this concoction that was called 10 and 10 that had two poisonous ingredients in it to make people vomit and have diarrhea. He felt like needed to purge the system, which of course is not helpful because you need the fluids in order to help fight off when you're sick, right? Especially if you have fever. But when he first started doing these things, he got positive feedback because those people didn't die. So he thought, okay, this is it. And he would pass that on as his cure. So there are a lot of other stories about yellow fever outbreaks. One of them was from Staten Island, where there was a riot. And then there was another one in Haiti. But those are different stories for different times. But that.
Well, it's really interesting to compare all these podcasts, really, or at least a lot of them, the ones that deal with these communicable illnesses that are spread. It's really interesting to compare what we knew then in terms of the medicine at the time or healthcare at the time versus what we know now and how different it is in some ways. And then also comparing some of the things about culture and society that are really similar, you know, the pushback against some things in terms of treatments, the denial in some cases of illnesses or the cause of illnesses. It's really pretty interesting. Well, you know, for your listeners, maybe not everyone knows what bloodletting is, and that's come up several times in this podcast as well as others. Maybe you should describe what that is so people can.
Bloodletting has been around a long time, and I don't describe it because it's one of those things where there's so many podcasts specifically about bloodletting, and it's been around since forever. But bloodletting is where you open up a vein and you drain the blood of a person because that's one of the humors. And there's four humors, thought to be four humors. And blood is one of them. Diarrhea and vomiting is another. There's yellow and then the black and all these. But bloodletting is one of those where they feel like if you take the blood out, it helps with inflammation. And where, of course, that's not the case, but the cure-alls is bloodletting. And as time had gone on, it was a little more controlled. So during this time, they would have controlled it with tourniquets so they wouldn't take too much. It was thought that the body had about 25 pounds of blood, which isn't true. And so they would try to take, this doctor tried to take almost half of that. So they would stop once a patient passed out. But they passed out because they had no more blood cells for oxygen. So anyway, that's pretty much what bloodletting is.
Are there any illnesses where bloodletting is actually a helpful treatment?
Yes, they still do it today.
Oh, really?
They still do them. They're rare diseases where there's too much blood, red blood cells in the system. Oh. It's usually something related to a type of cancer, and they have to take out some of the blood.
Okay.
Interesting. Also, donating blood is a sort of bloodletting.
Yeah, but that's not
for a cure. Technical
sense, right. That's not to treat the person donating the blood of an illness.
It's, right. No, there's very rare disorders where they do take the blood, and they're very rare. Hmm. Yep.
Interesting. I did not know that.
Maybe I'll do it in my next rare disease episode. I'll talk about the disorders that need bloodletting.
Well, I always wonder what are the, you know, we hear about treatments or knowledge of, you know, years ago, centuries ago, and they sound ridiculous, but I'm just always kind of intrigued with the idea of wondering what are the things that we do today that we think of as normal truths, you know, treatments, medical practices, or health related, or anything for that matter. What are the things that we consider to be true now that 100 years from now we may look back and think, oh my gosh, how did they think that? That's so.
Yeah, I think about that all the time. I think about it all the time, and I think about how, for instance, in 1793, Dr. Rush was probably thinking the same thing from 100 years before his time. What do people think before we started doing laudanum and wine or something like that? You know what I mean? And I think it's always going to be that way. I think there's always going to be things that we're going to learn in 100 years that are going to make what we do now seem so barbaric.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, definitely.
Like using a hammer for anesthesia.
Oh, yeah.
That sounds crazy, yeah. But that was.
Yeah, wait till I get to the lobotomy episode and the doctor uses an ice pick in the brain.
Yeah.
Well, I hope everybody enjoyed listening to that. And I thank you for being here with me again. And I hope that you'll join me again sometime. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Catch you in the next episode.
Bye.
I hope you enjoyed today's mental vacation from your current life. If you did and are curious for more, please subscribe. Before you go, if you have anything to add to today's show, or you have a topic that you think is worthy of dissection, please reach out on dissectingmedicalhistory.com or Instagram on dissectingmedicalhistory. Thank you, and stay curious.